dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World here in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's Monday, 5 p.m., February the 6th. That was Sarita singing Sunny, and of course that was Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny B," the night he hosted The Tonight Show, and I was his first guest. Aside from thanking Sarita and Francis for the song and the introduction, I would like to thank all of you for the really strong support of our show. So in that case, I have to start out by thanking my son specifically. Every 30 days, my son, Christopher, sends me the funds to maintain my John Barber's World, to express my thoughts, listen to yours, and interview some of the very best people on the planet, one of whom you'll be hearing in just a few short minutes. My son and I call this financial underwriting month-to-month resuscitation. A lot of my Facebook friends voted for and are Trump supporters, and a lot of them have a great sense of humor. That's why they voted for him. The joke's on us. I am, as you know, no fan of Trump's, but I am a fan of truth. The other day, you saw in response to when that draft-dodging mouth that roars Bill O'Reilly said to Trump about Putin, that Putin was a killer. Trump's immediate response was, "We're no angels. We've got a bunch of killers here." I have not heard that kind of honesty since 1980, when Jim Garrison said to us, and it's in part two of the Garrison tapes, the American media in the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, out soon, that the CIA kills in America every day. And one of the biggest killings may be the one that our guest will be talking about shortly. One of my Trump supporter fans in Indiana, Dennis Porter, sent a cartoon, which I posted for you all. After all, folks, funny is funny. It shows a guy asking Jesus how he feels about immigration. And Jesus says, quote, "Remember, heaven has a wall and a gate and tough bedding to get into." Now, last night, I posted on my Facebook page that I was probably the only one in America not watching our country's leading bread and circus act, the Super Bowl, which I gave up after last year's Deflategate. Instead, I watched Casablanca on TCM for the sixth time. But I was stunned because within a half an hour, I got nearly 100 similar encouraging comments from all of you folks telling me all of the creative things that you were also doing. Now, of course, aside from the game, I had no interest in seeing the Super Bowl wheeling out George Bush for the coin toss. If the Super Bowl is going to inflict one of the Bushes on me, then the halftime act should have been the Dixie Chicks. For that, I would have tuned in. Bush was there for the coin toss. To me, that is all the Super Bowl should ever be, a coin toss. Heads, New England wins, tails, Atlanta wins, and go home. And, of course, one fan who did stay and watch the whole game said, "I missed the greatest game in history." And to paraphrase Casablanca, one of the characters, especially Bogart, he says, "Here's looking at you, Johnny." That being said, I love watching athletes. As Hamlet observed, "What a piece of work is man, in action how like an angel." The reason I love watching athletes, it shows humans physically at their very best, not at Walmart. But sports, sadly, is now the only place in America where we expect excellence. We once used to expect it in every area of our society, but no longer. Now we're thrilled with just running into competence. The one other place, though, that I find excellence is with every one of my guests, especially if they're writers and authors. In my post yesterday about tonight's show, I said the most important book ever written about the assassination of President Kennedy was Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment, which opened the floodgate of facts into the hapless, hopeless Warren Report. A book, though, that may rank right up there now is called The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. It's a detailed book into the mysterious death of one of America's favorite media stars, Dorothy Kilgallen, as well known as Kennedy himself. Her mysterious death followed her exclusive interview with Jack Ruby when she said she was going to break the story wide open. And that story is also in part two of the Garrison tapes. And now to the real storyteller. If you go to his site, you'll be stunned by astonishing diversity of his books, about 20 in all, and a few that deal spectacularly with the Kennedy assassination. He's an accomplished lawyer. He's a network legal advisor, an independent public speaker, and the author of this extremely powerful book called The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, The Author Who Knows a Lot More, Mark Shaw. Mark, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show.
Oh, John, thank you, and I enjoyed your comments there. I didn't watch the Super Bowl either. I'm just like you. I had no interest whatsoever, so we went to a double feature. How's that? And just had a movie day.
What two movies did you see? I saw.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know that I would ever see it again, but I was captivated with Robert De Niro's new film, The Comedian, from the previews that we saw. And it is it's shocking with the language and everything else, but there's some incredible laughs in there, and it's lighthearted, and he's excellent as usual. And then the best film, of course, is Lion, which is the Academy Award-nominated film about the young boy who gets lost in India when his brother leaves for a little while. He then is transported over to Tasmania, adopted by a couple there, but it haunts him that he can't find, you know, his homeland. He can't find out where he was from. And finally, he's able to pinpoint that and goes back to India. And I don't want to spoil it for people, but it's a very uplifting film with great acting. It's no wonder. I think it got 6 or 7 Academy Award nominations. So that was a lot better than any Super Bowl junk that we might have watched.
Well, you know, Mark, that sounds astoundingly like a film about a tiger that I saw 2-3 years ago. Ah. Oh, my gosh, I wish I could remember it. I think it was nominated for an Oscar and may have won an Oscar. I'll see that also. I am having been a comedian once myself, I am a fan of comedians. It is by far the hardest job in the entire world. I mean, if you're a singer, Mark, you stand up there singing somebody else's song. You've got either a guitar or an orchestra behind you. And even if you're in the Army, you got a battalion of guys with rifles. But if you're a comedian, you're standing up there bare-souled. I mean, it is really tough. And I'm surprised that you say De Niro does a nice job. To me, De Niro is a lot like Marlon Brando was. Brando was brilliant. There was nobody comparable when he played a heavy. The same with De Niro. But when Brando tried to get lighter, when De Niro tries to get light, it just doesn't work. But having once been a comedian, I will go to see that film on your recommendation. The foul language doesn't bother me, only even though I never use it. But I'm looking forward to Lion. Also, I'm looking forward. When I start interviewing somebody, just so that I know more about them and the folks listening know more about them. Just first of all, you're calling from where?
Just out of sight of San Francisco, not too far away from you. I thought you were on the East Coast, but you're in the Las Vegas area, right?
Yes, I'm in Las Vegas. Great. I'm a Southern California refugee.
Aha.
Anyway, when you tell us a little bit about where you were born, a little bit about your parents, your siblings, where you went to school, what you really thought you wanted to be when you were younger, and did you happen into writing by accident, or were you addicted to it from it being a youngster?
Well, I ought to be an inspiration to any writer out there who wants to publish books, because I never had any idea, John, that I would do this. I'm from a small town in Indiana, struggled through Purdue to get through there in almost 6 years. Mostly I played golf and chased women, and so I got pretty much a degree in nothing. Went on and had some odd jobs, got fired a couple times and everything, then decided to go to law school. At one point, I thought I had better grades in law school, but when I went back to check with that, I didn't. And so I had no idea that I would ever get involved in anything like writing. I became a criminal defense lawyer, and for several years practiced in the courts, mostly all murder cases. And I really enjoyed it, although there's not any drama like being in the courtroom. But finally, I'd had enough of that. I was a public defender for a while and a regular practice, and I decided to give that up. And I've had a lot of spiritual nuances to my life, and one of them was that I had moved to Colorado near Aspen, and lo and behold, Claudine Longet, who you, I'm sure, remember, and many of the listeners may, when she shot Spider Savage, her lover,
yes.
There was going to be a trial, and I had tried a couple cases with Lee Bailey, F. Lee Bailey, the famous lawyer, and he was going to cover that case for Good Morning America, but he had a trial coming up, so he suggested me. And it was a true blessing, because I did analyze that trial for ABC's Good Morning America. That led to some television work with them. And then some regular work with them. Then CBS decided to do a Monday night television program called People with Phyllis George, and
remember,
I was chosen
well.
To be the co-host. That lasted about 6 weeks before it got canceled. I ended up out in the LA area and started working in some different shows and things like that before I finally moved back to the Midwest, just at the same time that Mike Tyson was accused of raping the woman in Indianapolis. And the judge knew a little bit about me, and she offered me a deal to oversee the media for that trial. But that was my first big break as a legal analyst, other than the Longet thing, because I covered that trial for USA Today, CNN, and ESPN, wrote about it, talked about it. And then I was really upset with what happened to Tyson. I didn't think he got a fair shake in the courts. And that began the first of many books with the Justice Denied theme that I have, because I wrote a book called Down for the Count about the Tyson case. And that's what launched me into that book did well, and then I kept, I wrote another one, then I just kept going. And, it's something that I never thought I would get involved in. I never had any training or whatever. I kind of just winged it. But I'm pleased I chose that profession, because books can make a lot of difference, as you know, John, in people's lives. And this new one, obviously, is doing that. So you won't find a more blessed man in the earth, on the face of the earth, than me, because I'm doing what I like, which is to tell stories and write my books.
Well, I must tell you, you are a perfect example of what I've always observed, that the best things that happen to us happen by accident, and all the worst things are those things that are really and truly well planned. Mm-hmm. I would like to get to the business of the reporter who knew too much. Why did you? I got a little from reading about your background, I got a little of why you eventually got into it, but tell us what finally made you move to really get deeply involved in it.
Well, I never intended to write this book. I remember Dorothy Kilgallen best, like you do, and like most everybody who, we've heard from now, the book has just taken off because of the district attorney's investigation in New York, which we can talk about, and I've gotten so many emails from people around the world, the reviews in Amazon and all of that, but they all pretty much say the same thing. That's what I felt. I didn't know about Dorothy's other side of her life. I knew her from What's My Line. But while I was writing a book about Melvin Belli, the famous San Francisco attorney who represented represented the Rolling Stones, Muhammad Ali, and all of that. I was talking to a friend of his, a doctor in San Diego, and he said, you know, Mel knew Dorothy Kilgallen. And I said, well, what? He was on the What's My Line show? She said, oh, he said, oh, no, Mark, come on. She was an incredible investigative reporter who covered the most famous trials of the mid-20th century, the Dr. Sam Shepard case that became the fugitive, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, but most of all, her most famous case, besides her being a syndicated columnist that was syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country, was covering the Jack Ruby case. And he said, Mel met Dorothy Kilgallen at the Jack Ruby trial. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I had no idea about this, that this had ever happened.
How was she able to get the interview with Jack Ruby? And why did no one else in America, from Mike Wallace to Dan Rather or Walter Cronkite or Huntley Brinkley, why did none of them go after an interview with Ruby? Did she have to pay for it? And how did she get it? And how did they allow her even in there to talk to him?
Well, we all missed it. The authors of many of the famous books on the JFK assassination, there's nothing in there about Dorothy. And we can talk a little bit about why that is. But, again, people thought of her as a game show panelist, but she had this other life to her. And I think people need to know what the motive was for her getting involved in the JFK assassination, because that leads to the Ruby interview. And what happened was she and JFK were very close friends. They knew each other socially in New York. But at one point, she took her youngest son, third-grade student Kerry, to the White House. And while she was there, Pierre Salinger set up a tour, and John Kennedy came into the library, and he was so kind to Kerry. Kerry had brought some letters from his grade school class. JFK gave him a PT-109 pin for his lapel. And Dorothy just was so, you know, so pleased that, that JFK treated him that way. So when JFK died, it was personal for her, and she wrote in one of her columns right after, for the Journal American, right after Kennedy died, the what I remember is a tall man stooping over a little boy who brought letters from his class. That is the man who was assassinated in Dallas. And so right away, she decided to go to the Jack Ruby trial, and you know, she had the best sources of the time. New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America. So she had a credential. And one of my favorite photos of her is on the website, the DorothyKilgallenStory.org that we put up, where she's standing at the Dr. Sam Shepard case, and all the reporters are scattered around her watching her because she was the celebrity there. And
yes,
so she
was.
Went to the Jack Ruby trial, and she right away, as you'll read on in her columns and in the book, she knew, she believed that Lee Harvey Oswald was a dead end. Nobody could figure out anything about him. She focused in on Jack Ruby, and she became friends with Belli and co-counsel Jack Joe Tannehill. And on the reporter, or excuse me, on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, we have more than 50 videotapes of primary witnesses to hairdressers that were Kilgallen's best friends, but one of them is Joe Tannehill. And people can watch. It's in the book. You can see where the passages are, but you can watch on that website Joe Tannehill say why Ruby was respectful of Kilgallen, how the interview took place, where the interview took place, and what he believed they were talking about. So that's how it happened. And, you know, when everybody else was trying to get probably access to Ruby, it was Kilgallen who won the day, basically because of her friendship with Ruby, or with Belli and Tannehill, and the fact that Ruby wanted to talk to her.
Now, just a little bit then about Dorothy's personal life. I remember Jack Parr, who was, to me, the best talk show host ever. He and Dorothy had a running feud on the air, and he used to make fun of her her lack of a chin, called her Gump many, many times. She for companionship, she used to go with Johnny Ray, who is obviously a homosexual. Tell us a little bit about her personal relationships, if she was married,
Well, in my books, you know, when I'm like you, John, I'm interested in the truth, and when the truth causes you to you know, write about a subject, warts and all, that's what I'm going to do. My books are famous for that. I don't pull any punches. So as much a celebrated television star and investigative reporter, you know, she exposed Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission before it was supposed to be released, which put her in more danger as it leads up to when she was killed in November of 1965. She also had this other side to her, and it has disturbed some people who've read about it, but I think it's part of the story. And what happened is that she and her husband, Richard Calmer, who was a Broadway producer and unfortunately got on the downturn and had some alcoholic problems, they went their separate ways. And the first guy that she found was Johnny Ray, of all people, the famous singer, the little white crowd that cried and all of that. Yeah, he was known as a homosexual, but in effect he was a bisexual because they had a torrid love affair. She fell in love with him, and he fell in love with her, even though she was much older than he was. And you'll hear Johnny Ray talk about Kilgallen, how much he loved her and all of that. That affair kind of went its way, and then she kind of conveniently into her life came a newspaper man in Columbus, Ohio, and he was the last lover that she had and one of the main suspects in her life, but in her death. But the Johnny Ray thing is something that has amazed people because there's also a very startling fact in there that I put in the book having to do with the young son, Carrie, and who the real father may be. So I'll just leave it there, and people can make up their own mind when they read the book.
Now, the mystery man, was that Ron Pataki?
It certainly was, and... you know, we should turn to the fact that I'm so pleased. The New York District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., his office, my agent said it was 1,000,000 to 1 that I could get them in to look into Dorothy's case because it's 52 years old. But I pestered them with a letter and all my fresh evidence in the book, and lo and behold, Sue Edelman, who's a real spirit of mine and the New York Post writer, she got after him and finally posted an article a week ago yesterday that the New York District Attorney is, in fact, investigating Dorothy's death. And I'm so pleased that they're doing so. If people have any information about Dorothy's death back there, they can contact me or the DA's office. But one way or another, we're going to get to the bottom of what happened to her way back then. And you know, what's important here, again, is getting to the truth, because Dorothy was denied justice way back then. There was no investigation of any kind at all. Do you remember when she died at all, John? Do you remember anything about that?
I remember absolutely everything about it, because part of that story, with the exception of the Johnny Ray part, is in part two of the Garrison tapes, the American media, and the second assassination of John Kennedy. In order for the DA to open this case, which to me is like almost reopening the investigation into the murder of John Kennedy.
It is.
Because if this happens, and I'm sure it will, it's because of your book. So what was it in your book that compelled them to open the case? Also, I need to ask you, what do you think she meant when she said this would, her story would blow the case wide open? And did not she share this with Mrs. Smith, who is a friend or an assistant, who is also found dead?
Well, let's take both parts there. The first thing is there's no question in my mind that what triggered the DA to look into this was the fact that despite a staged death scene, failed autopsy, faulty autopsy, all of that, the corruption in the New York Medical Examiner's office at the time just flashes out at you when you read about it. It was mafia controlled at the time. I certainly believe that those responsible for Dorothy's death made it plain and simple that there was going to be no investigation of any kind. And so I think the government corruption part of this convinced the DA to look into it. They're looking into documents. I was told today that I'll be contacted by one of the detectives looking into the case. So I think that's what stuck out to them, that And you know what else, John, and I think you'll agree with this. When there's a proven homicide, which I prove in the book, there wasn't any accidental death or suicide or anything. When you prove there's a homicide, there's a victim. And as a New York Post article said, it doesn't matter if her name is Dorothy Doe or Dorothy Kilgallen. She's a victim and she has rights. And those rights were not given to Kilgallen when she died. Now, 52 years later, I believe that's going to happen. The other part of your question about, you know, Dorothy and what was going on in her life, whether she shared anything of her investigation with people or not, I don't believe that she did. She was very close-mouthed about this. She had an investigation file which disappeared when she died. You know, frankly, the killers here won because all of Kilgallen's investigation evidence disappeared. She never was able to finish the book she was writing for Random House. It's the worst example of censorship that you can possibly have. But they could not let this woman go back to New Orleans where she was investigating Carlos Marcello, talking to Garrison, whatever she was going to do. And so they had to shut her mouth. And Pataki was right in the middle of all of that. And hopefully, you know, you're right. I hope that this will lead, perhaps. You know, there's so much new evidence out there about the JFK assassination from reputable authors who have primary source material like I do, that there should be an investigation because for, you know, 50-some years there's been so much distortion of history, and young people especially need to know what really happened to John F. Kennedy.
Well, the remarkable thing you talk about when you talk about the DA's office and the coroner's office in New York reminds me so much of Bobby Kennedy. You know, I spent a year and a half trying. I was a co-chair of the committee to retain Dr. Thomas Noguchi as an independent coroner in Los Angeles. And his coroner's report states specifically that the bullet that struck him behind 2 inches from the back of the head because of the extensive powder burns. And the CIA, the LAPD, and the city of Los Angeles tried for years to get him to change his testimony, and he would not. Mm-hmm. And William Pepper, who tried to argue for parole for Sirhan, had all this evidence, and they wouldn't grant parole because they said Sirhan was a political prisoner. But you have accomplished something that nobody has been able to do. Garrison wasn't able to do it. Mark Lane wasn't able to do it. William Pepper wasn't able to do it. But Mark Shaw was with your book. That just shows you the power of the pen and the power of the truth.
Yeah, I think so. And it's people like you, John. Now look what you're doing. See, you're talking to me, and so many people now are going to hear my voice. And I'm the voice for Dorothy. I'm the voice for the truth here. But you're doing your part now, and I will say, you know, I applaud that so much because hopefully it'll make people stop and think. Even, you know, there's a connection to what's happening with today. Look at the media people that are being threatened here by, the powers that be. This is the same sort of atmosphere that was there when Dorothy was a journalist.
When Garrison investigated his case, he didn't just investigate Shaw and David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald. He investigated the origins of the CIA and the origins of Project Mockingbird, which was the CIA's invention to take over the American media. Mark, when I started in television, started the AM show in L.A. in 1970, a company could only own 5 stations.
Yeah.
Now, because of Clinton signing the Communications Act in 93, 95% of all media is owned by 6 corporations.
Yeah.
Now, what I'd like to ask you, because there are probably dozens of people out there wanting to write a book. I'll get back to Pataki.
Sure.
But when you wrote your very first book, did you know you would get it published, or did you know you would find an agent? And is all of this in one of your great books about how to publish a book?
Well, you know, I can say, you know, besides my writing the books, I mentor people, and some people hire me as a literary consultant because there is a strategy to do this. And unfortunately, I run across, two things. First, I run across so many authors, unfortunately, who fall for these scams with subsidy publishers who want all this money to get their book published. And it's absolutely, as one publisher told me in New York, it's the kiss of death to any career that an author wants to have, because it says that your book isn't good enough, that you couldn't get a publisher for it, a traditional publisher, and you couldn't use self-publishing like CreateSpace or Ingram Spark or one of those. It's just a scam. And I've had people call me and tell me they've lost their life savings because they go with these subsidy publishers and they end up with boxes of the book in books in their basement they can't sell. It's just a tragedy. But the other thing is that, unfortunately, writers don't want to work hard enough at this. When I hear somebody say a book is done, it's probably not done. I would love to rewrite every one of my books because I know I could probably do a better job. So people have to work hard and then learn the rules of the publishing business. You don't send a manuscript to a publisher. They won't read it. You've got to do a query letter and a book proposal, and they've got to be professionally written and all of that. So that optimizes the chances to be published. And I shout this out whenever I can because I love writers, and I am so disappointed when they don't do this right because they haven't got a ghost of a chance of getting their book published unless they follow the rules.
Well, I am certainly glad you shouted it out on this show, and I am going to be in touch with you. But I would like to get back to the business of Ron Pataky. How, because I know you can't probably say too much because you don't want to jeopardize anything about the case, mm-hmm. but how do you think Ron Pataky came to Dorothy? Why do you think Dorothy was attracted? Well, he's a handsome young guy, I guess. So tell me about that.
Well, here's what happened. We can trace Dorothy's footprint from the time that she interviewed Ruby at the trial, exposed his testimony before the Warren Commission. You'll hear one of the hairdressers say at that particular point she was scared for her life and her family. The other one says she told him if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it would cost me my life. She had taken a trip to New Orleans. And with her hairdresser, and all at once just told him to go back to New York because she didn't want anything to happen to him. She was going to make a second trip to New Orleans. Well, into her life, right about that time or a little bit before, came this Ron Pataky fellow who met her on a movie junket in Europe and kind of fell in with her. Well, he had a kind of a scattered background, some association with some mafia figures, some violence in her background, but she really fell for him and really loved Ron. And unfortunately, I think she shared some of her JFK assassination information with him. And she then, as you come to November 1965, believed that he was leaking some of that to the wrong people. And so her hairdresser suggested she confront Ron, and I believe he's the mystery man that she met at the Regency Hotel just a few hours before she died on November 7th, 1965, right after her What's My Line show. I've interviewed Ron three times. I told him I was going to come after him because I thought he had more to do with this than he was saying. I recorded the interviews. I sent him a copy of the book. I've done everything to let him know that he's under suspicion. And the main reason, and you ask again why the New York DA is honing in on this investigation, is because of what Ron Pataky wrote in two poems about Dorothy that people will read in the book. I don't want to give it all away, but it's a true crime murder mystery, but I think you'll understand when you read the book how I believe Dorothy Kilgallen was killed. And I don't think it's giving away too much to say that we believe either at the Regency Hotel or when she got home that a number of barbiturates were spiked into her vodka and tonic. And so there's a poem that Pataky wrote, and it has a little image of a bartender at the top. The name of the poem is Vodka Roulette, seen as a relief possibility. And here's the language. While I'm spilling my guts, she is driving me nuts. Please fetch us two drinks on the run. Just skip all the noise and make one of them poison. And don't even tell me which one.
Oh, my God.
Now, Ron has told me those are just humorous poems. There's another one that he wrote, too.
That
but
is
there's
not
no
very
question
funny.
In my mind that it has to be about Dorothy. And if you really look at each line of that poem, you know, for instance, while I'm spilling my guts, that means he's alluding to the fact that he was leaking some of her information out. So Ron Pataki needs to be investigated. He's 81 years old and lives in Ohio. I've given the DA all of that information, and my hope is that they will look into him, because if he wasn't directly involved in her death, he knows who was.
Well, Mark, I must tell you, it's just astonishing. You're to be thoroughly, thoroughly applauded for that. I thank you so, so much for being here. I would love if you'd come back in a month or so to give us an update on what's going on. I also want to talk to you about the publishing stuff and some of your other books. Where can people get The Reporter Who Knew Too Much?
Well, thank you. The two websites are thereporterwhoknewtoomuch.com, but that's a good one, and it has the book trailer and everything. But The Reporter Who Knew Too the DorothyKilgallenStory.org is where all of the photos, all of the quotes, all of her columns and articles, and these more than 50 videotapes are there. So that's where I would suggest people going, and then that will lead you. The book is available on Amazon. Actually, over Christmas, they ran out of books. So I've been so blessed that Dorothy's voice is being heard. I'm fighting for her and all of that, and I've received all these emails from people across the country. But I'm a big independent bookstore guy, so if people do want to get the book, hopefully they'll hit their local store where they can find it. But Barnes & Noble and Amazon obviously have the book as well.
Well, not only is Dorothy's voice being heard, but certainly yours is being heard loud and clear, because I've heard from a half a dozen of my fans. They've sent me the title to this, since they know I'm working on this second documentary that's going to be out shortly, part two of the Garrison tapes. And that's why I rushed to book you on the show, and I'm so thrilled I did. And I'll be more than thrilled if you come back in a month and we can talk again.
Well, as I say, John, it's people like you that are, you know, passing on the truth that I believe Dorothy came up with, and people can read the book and make up their own mind about it. But I thank you so much for doing this. I'm very honored to be on the show, as I said before.
Well, thank you so much. It's on Jim Garrison's tombstone, "Let justice be done, though the heavens fall." Anyway, thank you so much. Tell them once again the two sites.
The ReporterWhoKnewTooMuch.com and the DorothyKilgallenStory.org.
Mark, thank you so much indeed. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli and News Vandal.
Great music. All the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing
at last?
Well, beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer, and this is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World, every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific, right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific and I'd say historic film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you so much. Welcome back. And we're about now to visit one of the really true great investigative journalists and writers in America, who I'm thrilled to have on every one of my shows because I couldn't do the show without him. The author and creator of News Vandal from California, again, also Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show again. And I'm glad you're feeling so well and got a clean medical report.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a little bit of just, this is like personal blah, 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 which I'm not that, I don't like to indulge myself too much. But there was some thought that I might have thyroid cancer, which is not uncommon. It's actually the most curable cancer. And when I had my nodules looked at the first time, the doctor said, I know you're a journalist. Have you been to Fukushima? Which is like, you know, that's it's almost like a comedy punchline, you know. Hey, have you been to Fukushima lately? So, yeah. You know, but no, that came back clean. And that's great because I, like many, many Americans, depend upon the Affordable Care Act as utterly flawed as it is. And it's interesting, you know, what are the flaws about the Affordable Care Act? One of the things I think is interesting is the extent to which many of the opponents of Barack Obama opposed him because he was a socialist and he's a communist. And nothing could be further than from the truth, because the Affordable Care Act was actually a way of enshrining in perpetuity the health insurance industrial complex. It's a market-based solution to the problem of healthcare that was, of course, we know came out of Mitt Romney and Romney Care in Massachusetts, and it actually started as a position paper from the Heritage Foundation about the need for people to take responsibility for their own healthcare, and that's the, you know, that everybody has to buy into healthcare. You have to force people to buy in, and that's a conservative think tank. So, it's one of those funny things. We're in that position now where, well, your guy did it, so now it's okay that my guy did it. Well, just because my guy did it doesn't mean your guy can do it. Well, your guy did it, so my guy can do it, you know. And it's this binary blah, 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 where nobody is really getting a handle on what's happening. All they're doing is saying, well, my team is better than your team. No, no, no. My team is better than your team. It's almost like the Super Bowl where everybody couldn't stand Tom Brady and people watched the Super Bowl. By the way, one of the lowest rated Super Bowls in a long time. A lot of disinterest in football, interestingly enough. But
well, my instincts were right, and evidently Mark Shaw's instincts were right too. But I must tell you, quite honestly, I think the healthcare industry in America borders on truly being criminal. It's almost as criminal as student loans. And why people aren't in jail for collusion to corrupt the system and create this monumental sickness in Americans is beyond me. So anyway,
I want to touch on that because there's something that really interesting about this is such a great barometer of Donald Trump, much in the way I think that the commercials that you see during the Super Bowl are like a rectal thermometer in the ass of American culture. just pull it out and take the temperature. Donald Trump on pharma, on Big Pharma, all throughout the campaign, he talked about how Big Pharma has got to be reined in. He said they're getting away with murder. It's a shame the way they're charging people for drugs. Now, he was going to red states, many rural areas where people are hooked on opioids because they got hooked on these pain pills because the pharmaceutical industry had a, it was a big cash cow for them in these rural areas. And he was going on and on about Big Pharma, Big Pharma, Big Pharma. So last week, he gets Big Pharma around a table. And what does he say? He says that the reason why Americans are getting ripped off is not because the pharmaceutical industry is ripping them off per se, but because all of the other countries around the world do bulk pricing. In other words, Canada's got a single payer healthcare system. So when they buy drugs, they buy in bulk for the entire nation. So they get a massive discount, which is why people get on buses in Vermont and in Michigan and Wisconsin and go across the border to get drugs in Canada. Well, he said that the reason why pharma is charging too much to Americans is because these other countries are getting away with murder and not paying their fair share, which is like the ultimate sleight of hand. It's the ultimate bait and switch. The people who are responsible for it, as you say, this almost criminal enterprise, were right around the table with him. But what he was saying is, well, we'd like them to voluntarily lower prices, but what we're going to do is make it so they can lower prices by giving them tax breaks and speeding up the approval process for their drugs. And I guess if they have a Vioxx that kills thousands of people, oh well. I mean, this is the sort of the interesting insanity of Donald Trump, who seems to be a mixed bag, who says things that people go, oh yeah, oh yeah.
The other thing, though, Joe, the other thing about Big Pharma, every time they talk about the fact that some drugs are really highly overpriced, they say it's because of the research. Well, the drugs are out there because they've already been manufactured and researched. So what further research is there?
Oh, but I mean, they do research. I'll give you an example on OxyContin. The company that did OxyContin had a 10-year patent, and there's a little catch in the FDA's drug approval process, because there is a dearth of knowledge about how pharmaceuticals affect children. So if you're willing to test drugs on children, I believe under the age of 6 or 7, you can get an extension on your patent. So what did they do? Because they wanted to hold the patent on OxyContin, they went out and arranged to test OxyContin on children so that they could get this waiver to extend their patent so that they could charge brand name prices a little bit longer on that drug.
Oh my God, how could the government allow them to experiment on children? Children's immune systems haven't even developed yet.
And that's why drug companies avoid this testing, because it's considered risky and they want to avoid potential lawsuits. But you know, this company took the risk. Now, this is an example of also how the FDA is basically a revolving door between the pharmaceutical industry and the people who run the approval process. And this is one of the funny things about Trump's administration. When he sits around a desk around a table with a bunch of corporate leaders, and he talks about how China and Mexico are ripping off America, and I'm like, no, the people who have been ripping off America are the people sitting around the table with you. China and Mexico are just the money laundering sites. The people who've been getting rich off of sending jobs overseas are not the Chinese and the Mexicans, really. It's the corporations and the people on Wall Street who have arranged to do it.
What was your reaction to the comment that Trump made after Bill O'Reilly said that Putin was a killer, and I mentioned at the top of the show, and Trump immediately said, we're no angels, we're a bunch of killers too.
Well, he didn't say we're no angels. He said, we're killers and we've done a lot of killing. And I think there are a couple ways to look at it. I mean, this is the Iraq war was a mess thing, and that Iraq war was a mess and was a bad idea. I think was one of the initial hooks that captured a lot of people's attention way back when the campaign started. Can you believe this? 18 months ago.
Yeah.
So there, you know, it's these little kernels of truth. I wonder if this is the bait, and then comes the switch, because I can tell you what I'm seeing is that everything that he is doing, and one of the reasons why he wants to make nice with Vladimir Putin, is I believe is he wants to cut a deal with Putin so that Putin will cut loose Iran so that Iran can be targeted.
Oh, and my God, what this a brilliant observation.
Well, this is the ultimate thing. If you think about it, he's in the horse trading. He's getting ready for the horse trading. Maybe we'll, you know, maybe we'll give you Crimea and we'll let you have control over Syria as a client state. If you will then cut loose Iran, and if we give you Syria as a client state, Syria will no longer need Iran as a guarantor because they will be completely your client state. And that will allow us, because Bibi Netanyahu has met with Putin and Erdogan has met with Putin and Erdogan has made nice with Bibi Netanyahu. And the guy who links all these people together is National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who has met with Russians. He has made money off of Russian TV. He has been a lobbyist for an adjunct of Erdogan's government.
Then, Joe, then the question is this, basically. It's a two-part question. The first part of the question is, why attack Iran? Now, you could understand, you really can't understand it, but when you think about how evil this empire can be, you can understand Gaddafi because Gaddafi was no longer going to deal in the American currency. He was going to deal in gold. And the same was true with Saddam Hussein. He was no longer going to buy oil with American dollars. He was going to
deal. Iran said that they were going to do that last week as well.
Okay. Then that is probably what now.
Well, but this is after they started their belligerence. I'll tell you what's going on.
Hold it. Iran didn't start belligerent just because they fired a rocket, for crying out loud.
No. Iran is a fully functional nation state. If you think about it, where the United States, the targets they pick, they are weakened sectarian nations that are – it's like shooting fish in a barrel. The United States – if the United States – does anything with Iran, if there's any military activity, we're talking about Vietnam territory. You know, one of the things that the military planners of the United States never understood about Vietnam is that basically Vietnam had been beating back the Chinese for 1,000 years.
Exactly. Yeah, then the French.
The French. I mean, this was not like, you know, little namby-pambies in some country that was put together by colonialists of, you know, various tribes and different ethnicities that could be easily broken apart like Iraq.
If the United States starting shooting at them like fish in a barrel, is it for the purposes of American bankers because Iran says they're not dealing in dollars anymore, or are they doing it on behalf of Israel?
No, here's the scary thing, is that if you get into Michael Flynn's book and you start getting into Steve Bannon, they would like to engage in a massive global shifting civilizational struggle against Islam. And they believe that the way to do it is to incite the Islamic world into attack. And they, for some reason, Flynn actually believes that Iran is the linchpin of all global jihadist movements, which is complete and total, well, we're on BBS, horseshit. It's just because it's Saudi Arabia and it's madrasas that has been, but Donald Trump has, if you look at all the countries that were on that list, none of them are places where Donald Trump has hotels or business interests. So there's that too. But ultimately, they think Iran is the big prize. If you knock out Iran, you can then basically undercut the Shia movement. And then you basically, instead of having the two different branches, you take them down one at a time and you basically crush Islam. They would like a civilizational struggle. And I can tell you, if they want a civilizational struggle, Iran's the one to go after, because Iran is not going to be an easy one to stop. Iran is the one that actually can put up a fight and will create a massive globe-spanning war. Iran has asymmetrical options. It can shut down the Persian Gulf in a minute. And that is going to change the way the world works, because it'll stem the flow of oil to many economies around the planet.
Do you think Donald Trump may turn out to be a truly Jekyll and Hyde president?
We'll have to do that in 2 weeks, because Donald Trump is Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, that's a show unto itself.
Okay, thank you, Joe, very much. Where can folks get your news, Vandal?
Go to newsvandal.com. It'll little box will pop up, sign up, and then And you'll get the rundown. And John, as ever, always great to be with you. What a great interview at the beginning of the show.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Mike Kim, my producer, and thank you all very much for tuning in. Good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.